My plan for today is to talk about, does it work? No. It's on. Get unplugged. Now it's working. Subtle. I prefer it to be subtle. My plan is to talk about some standard 19th century things, such as the method of images, and the inhomogeneous problem for the wave equation. And then I'd like to move on and do 20th century work and talk about decay estimates for the wave equation, stemming from a classic paper of von Pfau in, I guess, in the 1970s, late 1970s. But first I wanted to ask, do you want, since there are so few homework doers in the audience, I shouldn't ask yet, but do you want me to assign more homework? Because the last homework set was a little bit copious. I'll try not to assign all the problems I had in mind, but I have a few which I still like, and I'll assign when they come up, since nobody makes any comments. Okay, let's get going. I want to talk. We're in section, at least according to my organization, we're in section 4.3. It's called the method of images. So it's common to pose the wave equation as an initial value problem. So again, let's put down our equation 1, which is the wave equation. And I want to pose that initially, u is some displacement, and it has some initial momentum. But it's very common to, it's not always the case that we pose this for all x in Rn. So we might have the case that we want to have x in some domain inside of n-dimensional space. And that might not be all of n-dimensional space. And if we do, then we're going to need boundary conditions on the boundary of the domain along with my initial data. And common boundary conditions, common cases, as you can imagine, are Dirichlet, that is, we ask for u of x for all t to equal to 0 for all t in question. Since we can go backwards and forwards with this equation, I ask for all t in R and for x in the boundary. So that's one case. And of course, there's another common case, which is Neumann, which is we take the gradient of u, x, t, and you dot that with the normal, maybe the exterior normal, doesn't matter. And you set that equal to 0 for all t in R and x in the boundary. And there are other cases too. But those are very common cases to study. So I don't want to do all of these cases. Let's see, for the new arrivals, I handed out the problem sets, which I'll get to you on the break, if indeed I owe you a problem set. And then I asked the question, do you want more problem sets? And the answer was, I didn't hear anything, so I said, I'll try to keep my demands down, although many problems come to mind. Many good problems come to mind. Many good hard problems come to mind. So I don't want to discuss all domains. I don't want to discuss this in a general case. I actually want to discuss this only in several interesting and probably the most important cases, because phenomena are associated with it. So I will discuss the initial boundary value problem, So such a thing is, I give initial data, but I also prescribe boundary data. In this case, the boundary data is zero, homogeneous boundary data. So I'm going to do the initial boundary value problem. That's what this is called. Only in one case, for omega to be the half space, so Rn plus. So that's equal to x. I'm going to decompose it as x prime xn. So x prime is going to be an Rn minus 1. And I'm going to ask that xn be positive. And of course, the boundary is, I guess the boundary looks like Rn minus 1. It's all the, which is to say, all the x's with xn equals 0, of course. And at infinity, what about infinity? I should say something about the solution at infinity. However, it's a problem with finite propagation speed. So infinity affects us at a point x only after infinite time. So in some sense, you can think of, I'll take my data and I'll decompose it into compactly supported data, and then each term of that compactly supported data doesn't see infinity ever. So it's kind of a nice thing. So infinity makes less of an impression here than for, say, the elliptic or parabolic equations. Finite propagation speed. So what is, so Dirichlet, of course, this Dirichlet condition turns into u of x prime 0 t equal to 0 for all x prime and t. And Neumann turns into, well, the exterior normal derivative is minus d by dxn. Minus is a little bit of a affectation of u. Then you evaluate that at xn is equal to 0. For all time, you want that equal to 0. So for, again, for all x prime and t. And that's the problem I want to solve. And it's special because of a certain symmetry properties of the half space. And it's, in some sense, still the phenomenology is general, because there's some general thing that happens with solutions which I want to exhibit even just in one dimension, which is true in all initial boundary value problems, but in particular we can see it very easily in the half place problem. So this is special. As I said, it's special because one way to say it is because the boundary, so it's because the boundary is invariant under a transformation T, which takes x prime xn to x prime minus xn. Of course, you can invent any old domain. You can invent some way of putting the inside out or the outside in, at least if it's simply connected. But this also preserves the wave equation. So that is, if I have a solution u of xt, and I make a new solution v, a new function v of xt, which is u of this transformation of xt, which I guess I'll write out explicitly, it's u of x prime minus xn and t, then v is also a solution. And so then let's do the following thing. So now let's just, now kicks in the method of images. And I'm sure many people have seen the method of images, even I think I talked about it last semester. So let me just see who's seen the method of images. Lots of people. Who's not seen the method of images? That's harder because people are shy. Most people who bothered to move their arm. I'll take that to be as most people. Nonetheless, excuse me, I'm going to present the method of images. Let's say it this way. We are given data, f of x and g of x, for which x's? X in R n plus only. That is, we don't know f and g for all x in R n, only for the half space. So the method of images consists in cleverly defining data on the rest that we've left out in such a way that when you solve in all of Rn, your boundary conditions are going to be, conditions will be satisfied. So let's do the following thing. For the Dirichlet case, extend both f of x and g of x to all of Rn, but as odd functions, which is to say explicitly as if f of x prime minus xn, let's suppose xn is positive, then I want to be able to define it for negative entries in this place. It's just as minus f of x prime xn. And the same for g, completely simple. And now the data is odd, so the data is odd with respect to t, and the equation is preserved by t, and we can conclude that the solution is odd with respect to t also. And so I'm now going to look at u of x t stemming, what I should say just a little bit more, what I skipped, sorry. I extend my data and then I solve in all of Rn. I said that, but I just want to make sure. Solution on all of Rn also is odd with respect to t. And so so then that says that so then what I want to say is a continuous odd function there is one which vanishes on the plane of symmetry. So as long as, or if u of xt is continuous in Rn, that's the x's, cross R, that's those are the t's, or even continuous in R, an x for each t, then it's guaranteed that u of x prime 0 t vanishes, which are the Dirichlet conditions. That is the Dirichlet condition. So when is it going to be continuous? And the answer is, all you need is one compatibility condition. So this brings up the word compatibility conditions. It will be continuous if the data is well, you need a couple of things. So let me say the following. The most important is if a compatibility condition is satisfied. At xn equals 0 is satisfied. Namely, if I take f and I reflect it, its values at xn equals 0 better be negative of each other. That is, they better be 0. So that is f of x prime 0 better be 0, and the same for g. There's a second bit which will demand that it be continuous. And we've, what can I say, it's just a technical statement, but strictly to be continuous, you need it. And that is, the method of images tells you you need some derivatives of the data in order to avoid focusing singularities. So also need f in, what was it, cn minus 3 upon 2, and g is in cn minus 1 upon 2. N minus 1, N minus 3. Just to make sure that it's continuous in all of Rn. And the idea is that, let me just say, if not, I should draw pictures. I'm lacking pictures. Here's x and here's t. If not, you're given data here, and you're demanding that the solution be 0 here. If there's incompatible data, then a singularity can enter into your domain. And this can be seen analytically, as we're doing, but also if you happen to do numerical analysis and you screw up at the corner, you will see singularities in your solutions. So if not, singularities can enter your solution. And it's not just a singularity on the boundary. It will enter into the interior of your domain. Singularities can enter the interior of the domain as time increases. Let me just comment slightly about that. I'm asking that u of x be several things. So in particular, when xn equals 0, I'm asking it to be equal to 0. So along here, I'm asking it to be 0. Let's see, this is maybe x1, and maybe this is xn. So I'm asking, let me do this again. Here are my axes, here's xn. And here's x1. And so I'm asking that all along this whole plane here, how do I denote that? I want u to be equal to 0. But along t equals 0, I'm asking u of xt to be equal to f of x. So along here, I'm asking u of xt to be f of x. And so if u has to be 0 here and f of x equal here, I better have f vanishing on the xn equals 0 plane. So that's this compatibility condition. Secondly, I'm asking that d by dt of u of xt equal 0 on xn equals 0, because, of course, the time derivative of 0 is 0. And I'm asking it to be g of x on t equals 0. And so in order that those are both compatible with being a C2 function up to including that corner, I have to ask the second. So these are compatible with u of xt being a classical solution, even just be compatible with u of xt being a C1 function in that corner region. Okay, a word about Neumann. How about Neumann? What happens with Neumann? Well, let's see. What do I ask? I ask that partial x n u of x x prime 0 t equals 0. Sorry, let me write it this way, in this table form. Partial xn of u x t equals 0 when xn equals 0. But also, I ask it to be equal to partial xn of f when t is equal to 0. So I look, what is the xn derivative of u demanded to be down here? Well, the xn derivative of f, and the x would be 0 on here. So the compatibility condition is that x n derivative norm of x n derivative of f at x prime 0, when x n is equal to 0, should be equal to 0. And the same, of course, with the d by dt. So the same with d by dx n, and then d by dt of u of x t. That should be equal to 0 here, and partial x n of g of x here. So that gives me a second compatibility condition. And let's go back to this odd extension. What happens with so this is what the demands you are making on u if you want u to be even C1. What am I going to do to my data if I want to solve the Neumann equation? Well, of course, you extend the data to be an even functions of xn for the Neumann conditions case. Of course, that means, as I've been writing, you say f of x prime minus xn is equal to f of x prime xn, and g of x prime minus xn is equal to g of x prime xn. And then the question is, somewhat independent of the above considerations, do I do something like this and retain a smooth function, or retain a function with one derivative, say, or several derivatives? It has to be the derivative of f in the xn direction has to vanish on the xn equals 0 coordinate hyperplane. And so that's precisely this condition. Good. I haven't solved anything. All I've done is saying, make your data look like that. So now let's solve something. We need to solve something. Yeah? If I extend it odd, I need my initial data to vanish at the origin. If I extend it even, I need the derivative of the initial data to vanish at the origin. It's the same count and conditions, just slightly different. It's a cosine series or the sine series, you might say. Does that answer your question? Let's solve an equation. So we could do spherical means in general, but I think it's more fun just to do one-dimensional, because we'll see the phenomena that I want to exhibit. So let's do the one-dimensional case. And let's see what this is. So I, of course, have partial t squared u minus partial x squared u. There's no x1 or xn. It's just x. And I have D'Alembert's formula. So let's go back to D'Alembert. D'Alembert tells us that u of x t is equal to, well, we average the values of f of x plus t plus f of x minus t. Then we add to that the integral of g between those two points, x minus t and x plus t, g of y dy. So let's draw a picture then of that solution. Well, here's x, here's t. And let's choose a point here. As a first example, this is my first point, x1, t1. I need maybe a little bit more axis here to make it look neat. And then, I draw the backward light cone. I need f from these two points and g between them. That's the typical picture that I've been drawing over and over again. And the solution doesn't even see the boundary. Finite propagation speed. So this is a solution whether we changed f to odd or even or not. It doesn't matter. So that's a solution. But of course, now let's take another point here, which is a little bit more interesting with regard to the boundary. and do the same thing. Remember that I, of course, have data only given over this ray, the positive ray, and I've extended the data to be odd over here. So having done that, I have data everywhere. This finding my value of my data here, I look over here for it. So, and then the solution here, of course, is I evaluate this point, and I evaluate at this point f, and then I integrate all of g across that line. So on the other hand, so I have this formula for case x1, t1, which I have not seen the boundary yet. That says that x is bigger than or equal to t. So this is what happens when x is, but then you have to switch formulae when x is less than t. And the formula yet, of course, well, is u of x t. Well, let me say it again. You don't have to switch formulae. You can still use this, but you'll be looking at values of arguments of f and g, which are negative. So the typical thing when you make a Green's function is use that relation you had before to actually only refer to arguments of f and g, which are positive. So u of x and t is equal to 1/2. What happens when I have to pick up the value of f here? Well, I should say it's the negative of the value here. So it's 1/2 f of x plus t, which is the value here, so I don't change that, but minus the value of f of x at negative the argument, t minus x. Since t is bigger than x, that's a positive argument. Plus, of course, 1/2. Now, when I integrate between this point and this point, I claim the integral from here to here is 0. It's because it's the integral over an even integral of an odd function. So all I have to do is integrate from here to here. So it's 1/2 the integral from t minus x to x plus t, g of y dy. And that's the formula. That's a formula which only refers to positive arguments of f and g. And you can see that the solution values here, what do they depend on the initial data? They only depend on f here, and the interval between them. Isn't that interesting? And the data goes and bounces off the wall and goes up there. That's what it does. Okay, now let's test my artistry even more by saying, what does the solution look like? So here's x, here's t, and I'm going to give some initial data. I'm going to superpose it on the board in blue. And let's see if I can give you a picture of what the solution is going to look like. So what I want to do is this thing. Let's see. I have to prepare a little bit. If I prepare, then my picture will look a little bit better. So I want to give initial data looking like this. So here's XT space, but on the top of it, I'm going to superpose, so to speak, graphs of what I want my data to look like. And I'm going to mix f, little f and little g, so that, in fact, I'm only making the big f and the big g of our left and right decomposition. But let's just bide with me. So here's maybe an initial profile made out of little f and little g so that it's only moving in that direction. But I'm solving the Dirichlet problem, so I also have to add f and g negative when it's over here. So that says negative means this bump is now a dip. And it's moving in that direction. And then at later time, the solution is 0 there. And that's a compatibility condition that I've left the solution, the data, so it's 0 there. At later time, of course, this bump moves. Oh, I wanted to make this a dotted line. So this bump moves. So and interacts with the boundary. And this moves out, so now I have this is turned into a ghost. This is the ghost you put there to make sure the boundary conditions are always satisfied. This now turns into a ghost, while this image has turned into the solution, which is moving like that. And then at a later time, that solution is going like this. Got it wrong. Exactly the opposite of what I wanted to draw. It's this thing. It's moving in that direction, while the ghost is this thing, moving in the imaginary part of, moving in the manufactured part of your domain. And of course, the phenomena that I want to exhibit, given by this formula, is that your pulse is inverted. So, inverted pulse. Right? That's what happens. So now let's do the Dirichlet one-dimensional case. Oh, sorry, the Neumann. This is the Dirichlet case. One-dimensional case, I should have said very clearly, Dirichlet boundary conditions. Because now I want to do the Neumann boundary conditions case. So that says, what is it? F of x is equal to, sorry, f of, I guess I could have used the notation f of tx is equal to f of x, and g of tx is equal to g of x. And now, from D'Alembert's formula, I have when, of course, the same situation, when x is greater than or equal to t, it's the same. X is big enough so that you are not, so your solution doesn't depend on any, on the boundary. And so you can put it in or take it out, and it doesn't matter. It's the same for finite propagation speed. When t gets big, though, the solution's different. And when t gets big, I have to write it down a different solution formula. So it's u of x, t, is equal to, and the point is I want to make sure that I only refer to aspects of the functions f with positive argument. So again, I'm supposed to pick up this value, but it's really the same as that value, but with a plus, because we've reflected even rather than odd. So it's f of x plus t, and that's a big number, plus f of t minus x. The difference, this plus and this minus, are to be contrasted. Then, of course, plus 1/2, we can do the same thing. This integrating over this interval is integral over this subinterval plus the remainder. So let me do the remainder first. So I integrate from t minus x to x plus t, g of y dy. But then there's this amount which is remaining, and it's an integral over an even integral of an even function. And so there's something that's there. In fact, it's the integral over this twice. So twice cancels the 1/2, plus integral from x minus t, sorry, from 0 to t minus x of g of y dy. So you count half what contributes to the solution here in the Neumann case is half of this, half times this integral plus 1 times this integral. That's just the way it goes. And that's the solution formula. And now let's see if I can make a picture. So here's x, and here's t. And again, I do this thing where I sort of sketch characteristics crossing, because I'm going to make data. This is the real data, an incoming blip. And it's image, but I make its image even rather than odd. And then at later time, those incoming blips interact. Let's see. And they interact a way which the derivative here is 0. And then at later time, when they pass through the wall and separate, the thing that's going in this direction, of course, is an upward blip. But this, too, is an upward blip. The front of it is as upward as before. And so it reflects even. it's non-inverted pulse, so it's an upright. And that's what happens with Neumann conditions. You can, you don't have to believe me, you can do the experiment with a jump rope tied to a door handle. And that's the Dirichlet case. In the Neumann case, a little harder, a jump rope tied off a loose knot to a vertical bar, something like that. But in any case, that's the method of images. So I have a couple questions. And of course, the questions are the problem set, but maybe I don't want to overload you with problems, so I'm going to ask one as a question and one as a problem set. So here's a question. And that is, the method of images doesn't, you don't just have to do it with a half plane. You could have a half space. You could do it actually with a region between two planes, but you have to do infinitely many reflections. You could also do it to a region which is made out of the intersection of two R pluses. How do I want to say this? Or you could say you can make an orthant. So that's what I wanted to ask about is method of images for an orthant. I'll call that Q. Well, I'll just do the three-dimensional case. The positive orthant, that's equal to all the X's in R3 such that X1 is positive, X2 is positive, and X3 is positive. So I take the upper half space with respect to X3, upper half space with respect to X2, and the upper half space with respect to X1, and I take their intersection. And now I can solve the wave equation using images. So my question is, can I? Well, let's impose some conditions, and I'm going to say, how about just impose Dirichlet for thinking? How many images do you need? So just how many images? And then let me ask one more thing. Let's see. So we live in three-dimensional space, and boats do too, and they send radar so boats, big boats moving along wants to know where the small boats are, so it sends out radar. But radar doesn't reflect very well off a sail of a sailboat, so they have very small radar profile. So a small boat in a place where big boats move often have radar reflectors. Anyone seen those? They sit on the mast, and they're about this big. They have to be about or a little bit larger than typical radar wavelength, which is about this big. And they look like an intersection of three planes, and then chopped off to look nice. So let's see if I can draw a picture of this. They look something like this. And then like this, and then like that. You see that? It's three planes, this, this, and this, then it cut off to look nice, and it has the interesting property of being, a little sideways octahedron cut out of the around the origin in three space, and this Q3 is one of these regions. So you just intersect that with Q3 plus, that's intersect with a local octahedron. And so a ray comes in, and it goes out, and it has the property of going out in the straight, or at least if a ray came in, it goes the property of going out in the same direction that it came in. And so since radar works by reflection, and that's perfect reflection, it increases, a small thing can increase your radar image enormously. So you put this way up high on the mast, and big boats can see you even in the fog, despite the fact that you have your hull is about this high and the rest of your ship is made out of cloth. You know, you look big, but if you look at it radar, you don't look big at all. So my question is, so this is a model for this, and wave equation is a model for radar. And so my question is, my first question was how many images, and my second question is, I'm going to impose Dirichlet conditions. How does the image come out? Does it come out upright or inverted? So upright or inverted? And in which direction? That is, I made some vague sketch, but show me that direction. Okay? So that's a question. It's not a problem set unless you feel like showing me what what your thoughts are. So, but don't do it for this. Do it for Q3 plus. I mean, do it for the whole orthant. But I do have a problem set problem. Let's see. Five. I've lost whether it's four or five. I think it's problem set number five. Which is my first problem on that problem set. I'm only going to give you one problem here. It has a few parts, though. Which is, you don't have to restrict the method of images to the wave equation. You can perfectly well use it for other equations, as long as this reflection preserves the equation, like the heat equation. So solve the heat equation, which of course is our d by dt u is equal to 1/2 Laplacian u on R n plus, so with the initial boundary value problem for the heat equation, with of course u of x 0 is equal to f of x, with first part Dirichlet boundary conditions, and then the second part Neumann boundary conditions. And give me the explicit solution, an expression for the explicit solution. That is, write something which I can integrate over R plus, Rn plus, that only refers to the initial data in terms of Rn plus, which will imply that the solution, which will give the solution satisfying the right boundary conditions. So give the, what I want to say is the integral kernel. It's the heat kernel solving the Dirichlet conditions. So give the integral kernel. In both cases. Okay. That's interesting. And now I want to compare the kernel. So the Dirichlet kernel will be a function of V, X, and Y, and T. And the Neumann kernel will be another function of N of X and Y and T. And compare with the heat kernel. The heat kernel was a function of x and y of t over all of Rn. So that's h of x, and it turns out to be a function of x minus y t. Of course, that heat kernel is a convolution operator, and it only depends on x minus y because both the equation and the domain are translation invariant. But of course, when I put boundary conditions on a hyperspace, on a hyperplane, it's no longer translation invariant. So it will depend on x and y in ways which are not just x minus y, of course. Compare with the heat kernel. And so what I want to do is I want a specific comparison. How do I want to say this? Let me try. That is, for fixed x, y, and t in the domain, so that's in Rn plus, that's x, Rn plus, that's y, R plus, that's T, which is bigger? That is, which has more heat? Or, given a delta function at T equals 0 at point Y, is it hotter for which problem at X at some time T in the future? Does the difference change sign, or is it doesn't change sign? Which is hotter? So which one is bigger? And then state a maximum principle on this, given this. State a maximum principle. State a theorem, which is a maximum principle. I mean, what do you think? Which one do you think should be bigger than smaller? And is that preserved? Is that independent of x and what have you? So it just means that you get used to the method by doing that. Good. Give me a moment to erase, and we'll move on to Duhamel's principle, which is another section. Everyone got it? It's a little harder in the sphere for wave equations, but for Laplace's equations, the sphere is good. It's like the classification of transformation groups which leave Laplace's equation invariant. Or so it's things that are Lorentz invariant, or depends a bit like on the geometry. But it's a little slightly bigger because if I transform Laplacian u equals 0 to a factor times Laplacian u equals 0, that also solves Laplace's equation because the Laplacian part cancels, but there's a factor there you don't have to worry about. So slightly more general, but not that much more general. But finite dimensional set of transformation groups. Pretty rigid. So the general theory of initial boundary value problems actually doesn't usually rely on exact formulae. I'm just doing the exact formulae case partly to exhibit this phenomenon of reflection inverted and reflection not inverted. So let's move along. And I want to talk about section 4.4. So these are two short sections. I want to talk about Duhamel's principle. So I want to, so far we've had had homogeneous problems. That is, I've always been solving an equation like this, partial t squared u minus Laplacian u equals 0. What I want to do is figure out what happens if I have a function here. And since my interest and very possibly your interests are very often in nonlinear problems, that h could be a function of u, and there could be an intermation method where the nth iterate is based on n minus 1. And so it's very important in studying nonlinear problems to understand very well the homogeneous problem. Just call that an H and see what properties of H are going to be reflected in the resulting properties of U. And so let's give, of course, initial data as well with U of X 0 is equal to our traditional F of X partial T U of X 0 is equal to G of X. So what I wanted to do was step back a little bit from this and give a general principle for inhomogeneous problems to equations, which evolution equations in time, and apply it in particular to the case of the wave equation. So I want to give a general principle. And it's related to what's called the formula for the variation of constants, the variation of constants formula. Sometimes called the variation of parameters, variation of constants formula, in ODE. And it's a principle which applies to ODE, to PDE, in a great generality, and there's no big surprise, but it's just nice to know. So let's first study this problem, and let me reduce it to a slightly, to a, to a, to a, to a, it's component cases. So let's first divide the problem into components. So I'm going to set u of xt, my solution, I'm going to set u1 of xt plus u2 of xt, where u1 of xt will satisfy partial t squared u1 minus Laplacian u1 equals 0, but u1 of x is 0 is equal to f, and partial t u1 of x 0 is equal to g. So that will be my equation 2, and then my equation 3, I'm going to have partial t squared u2 minus Laplacian u2 is equal to h, but u2 initially is 0, and so is the initial momentum for u2. And then if I add u1 and u2 and I make u out of it, u does the following thing. Initially, u is the u1 contribution plus the u2 contribution, which is f. And its time derivative is the u1 contribution plus the u2 contribution, which is g. And if you apply the wave operator to it, the wave operator applied to u1 is 0, and the wave operator tied to u2 is h. And so you solved your problem. And it's because it's a linear problem. It's a very, very straightforward thing to do, is to decompose it like that. So since we know how to do the initial value problem for the homogeneous equation, let's do only the inhomogeneous problem. So let's only study the inhomogeneous problem. So, but what I want to do is change gears a little bit and not solve problem 1, but I'm going to solve just problem 1 or just problem 3. I want to solve problem 4. Solve an abstract form. A bit like this. So I'm already in equation 4. So I want to solve d by dt of v. How do I want to do this? Is equal to a of v plus h. And v, well, I want, where is v? And so with v of 0 is equal to some initial point, v naught, and I want v of t to be a curve, how do I say that? A curve from 0 to some interval into a Banach space. So I want v to sit in a Banach space, and v of t be a curve in a Banach space. Sorry? And v is first order in, yes, and my equation is first order in t, but v could be a vector function, could be just a vector in R2. It's just an abstract, and I'm going to give you a general formula in this case, and then I'm going to apply it to the wave equation. Oh, which is a good point. How do I make the wave equation look like this? Like wave equation in this form. Well, let's do the following thing. I'm going to set v equal to u of xt, p of xt. So I invent an extra function. I'm going to call it p, the momentum. And I'm going to ask in which Banach space. I think I'm going to ask that this is in h1 of Rn. That's for the u. And the second component, p, I want it to be in l2 of Rn. Say. And then, I want this to satisfy the following thing: d by dt of v. Well, that's of course this vector, which is d by dt of u, d by dt of p. I want that to be equal to the following thing: 0, the identity. So I want ut is equal to p. That's what the matrix says so far. I want I want p sub t, which is u sub 2 t, is equal to Laplacian u. And so that's u of x t. And so this is, by definition, this is going to be my a of v. Oh, but I forgot the h. So let me put in the h. So I want plus 0 h of x t. And now, by definition, it's a of v plus, run out of letters, capital H, which is the vector 0 little h. Okay, and now let's do the following thing. I'm going to ask the homogeneous equation have a solution operator. Ask that the homogeneous equation, the equation partial t v equals a v, v at 0 is given, have a solution operator or a flow. S of t, say. So that means that v of t is equal to s t v0 gives the solution to that. And if this is finite dimensional case, that is like, that solution operator is like exponentiating a matrix, e to the t a. But in for a PDE, that's some kind of operator on a Banach space, and you have to do analysis to understand that that operator actually will provide a bounded curve or a continuous curve or a smooth curve into these spaces. I want to never mind that analysis. I want to give you a formula, okay? It's just sort of a uniform formula in this setting. But in particular, you want this to be a semigroup, that is S of T plus T1 plus T2 is equal to S of T1 applied to S of T2. So I need that, and I also need that S of 0 I want to be the identity. And then I just want to give a solution. So I want to give you what is called the variation of constants formula in this setting. It says that V2 let me do the following thing. Let me solve V1 to be the, give the initial data. And then I'm doing the same thing. I've just solved the two equation. Now here's the three. So this is the two equation. And the three equation is going to be d by dt of v2 is equal to a of v2 plus h. And v2 initially is equal to 0. And the same trick is that you add the two, you get a solution of the full equation. Very simple trick. So let's now I want to have a solution. We know about v1. V1 is that. So what about v2? So this is the variation of constants formula, which I told you about. So this is equation 5. It's the variation of constants formula. It says v2 is equal to the following thing. You integrate up to t the solution operator at t minus t1, t minus t1 of h of t1 dt1. That's it. And then, of course, the full solution, as I said, will be v of t is equal to v1 of t, which gives us the initial data, but gives us 0 instead of h, plus v2 of t, which at 0, it doesn't ruin the fact that I picked up that initial data, but when you do operate with the differential operator, it's going to give me h, if that formula works. And so what I have to do is make sure that we understand that that formula works. So proposition, and now you think I've lost count, but I haven't. It's 4:12, because I guess the numbering system goes per section. We're on section 4 about hyperbolic equation. And what I want to say, the expression 5 solves the appropriate equation. So expression 5 solves the inhomogeneous equation. Well, my numbering system hasn't been so great. I guess it's a 3. I'll call this 2 prime and 3 prime. That means it's equation 3, but the general one, for my general problem rather than for my wave equation in particular. And let's check it. I mean, it's a small calculation. I mean, it's a short calculation. Who's seen this? Of course, we've all seen it in ODE class. But it's always nice to see it again and in context. So clearly, V2 of 0 is equal to 0. Because this is, well, that should be a Lebesgue integral. And an integral from 0 to 0 is 0. So V2 is equal to 0. So it solves at least one piece of that equation. But I have to make sure that when I differentiate, I get A times it plus H. And I'm screwing up my notation. This probably should be a big H because I have a little h down here. So let's differentiate it now. Partial t of v2, or d by dt of v2. It's partial d by dt, it's t, d by dt of, well, I'm going to repeat that expression, 0 to t, s of t minus t1, h of t1, dt1. Where does t occur? In two places, here and here. And so the result has to have two terms. So the first result is when this differentiation knocks off the integral, I'm going to get s at t is equal to, at t1 is equal to t. So s at 0, h at t. Which, since this is the identity, that's h of t. Plus, there's the time when the derivative hits inside, that leaves the integral intact by the chain rule. And I'm going to get d by dt of s of t minus t1 applied to h of t1 dt1. So that's equal to, this gives me h of t. And d by dt of s, well, s is the flow. So d by dt of s is equal to a on s. So that's equal to integral from 0, integral from 0 to t of a of s of t minus t1, h of t1, dt1. And I guess it exhibits the strength of the problem. It also exhibits something which I snuck by you, which is a doesn't depend on t. A problem with, what is it, non-autonomous problem, a problem with time-dependent coefficients is harder. A commutes with this time integration. As long as A is independent of T, it commutes with time integration. And so we have H of T plus A times, just recognize this is, that's V. And we're done. Now, if we were actually in a Banach space rather than a finite dimensional space, we'd have to check at most of these steps what S is doing, because it's an operator, and is it preserving the Banach space and all that. So let's skip it. The charm of the formula is as it stands. What I want to do is, and I want to finish up, this small subsection by doing it with a wave equation, of course. So let's apply the formula to the one-dimensional wave equation. So what happens? So that says U2 of xt, P2 of xt is equal to the integral from 0 to t, the solution operator on t minus t1, operating on 0, little h of x and t1, dt1. And what is that solution operator? Well, let's see. notice that this vector is 0, h. So when I start with initial data, I start with fg. So this is the case f equals 0, and I only look at the case g. So what's the solution operator? Oops, this is a Neumann case, but use a little poetry. The f doesn't count, it's an integral of g. So this solution operator is going to be the following thing. The big integral is going to be 1/2 integral up to t, that's this integral, of, well, that integral of g. So it's equal to integral from x minus t minus t1 to x plus t minus t1. This is t minus t1, that's why it goes there, of g of y, but at t1, so that's h of y at t1, dy, that's the solution operator, I guess the half should be inside, and after I do the solution operator at t minus t1, I then integrate dt1. And then what happens for p is, of course, d by dt of this, so same expression, integral 0 to t, 1/2 integral x minus t minus t1. We could differentiate, but I won't bother. H of y and t1 dy close dt1, and that's a vector, so I make a big parenthesis. That's what it is. How do we find u? Just read the top row. And the top row is u is equal to this. So that says u2 of xt is equal to, I'm just writing it out again, 0t, 1/2, 0t, integral from x minus t minus t1 to x plus t minus t1, h of y and t1, dy dt1. And that's one I want to exhibit as the solution of the problem for u2, the pure inhomogeneous problem. Well, you know me, it's never complete without drawing a picture, and then I'll stop for the pause. So what does this solution depend upon? So here's x, here's t, here's some point x1t, oh no, that doesn't work. Here's some point xt, I want to know the solution. So draw the backward light cone. It depends on f at these two points. So I'll say that u is equal to u1 plus u2, and I'm going to say what contributes to u. Well, u1 depends on f here, so f of x minus t and f of x plus t, and it takes 1/2 of it in each case. And then u1 also depends on g along this line, so the 1/2 the integral from x minus t to x plus t gy. Dy. So those two things contribute to u1. What is u2? Well, for fixed t1, it's the integral from here to here. And then you have to integrate from t1 from there to there. So it's the integral actually over this triangle. So the u2 is equal to 1/2 integral of h over this triangle. Dy dt1. It's a beautiful thing. Question to think about over the break. I did the R1 case. How about X and R3? My question is, what is the domain of dependence of a point X, t positive. Given that you have to integrate over backward light cones to get the u1. You integrate over the initial data on a backward light cone to get the u1. What is the domain of dependence of a solution, of the inhomogeneous problem of a solution in R3? Problem set problem. Problem 2. Given explicit expression, for the solution of the inhomogeneous heat equation. Right? So I have partial T U equals 1/2 Laplacian U plus H. And we can start out, we could just look at U2, the U2 case, we can start out with U of X, U. So this could be U2, U2, and U2. So we start out with zero initial data. If you want to add non-zero initial data, just add a U1. Let's stop for a short pause. Anyone who has homework owed to them, come see me. So I want to carry on. Oops. Yes, it's on. I want to carry on by talking about decay estimates for the wave equation. So we had a decay estimate already, which depended on the data being of compact support. So I want to move from that because partly the support question entered into the estimate, and that's not so useful in many contexts. So I guess I'm in section 4.5, decay estimates. For the wave equation. So let's see where we are. We're the standard equation, partial squared u t squared u minus Laplacian u is equal to zero, and I'm given initial data. U of x, 0 being f, our traditional notation, d by dt, u of x, 0, partial t, u of x, 0 is equal to g of x. And what I want to do is talk about how solutions decay. So how do solutions decay? Or how fast do solutions decay? And of course, the answer is, by what means do you want to measure them? So result one, which is a theorem. I think it's 4. Now I've lost track. 4.13. I just gave a theorem 4.12, so it has to be a 4.13. But I just want to check. Theorem 4.13 says, if we measure in a sublev space, solutions don't decay. So let me say it the following way. Consider solutions of 1 with initial data f in hr plus 1, g in hr, then the solution will satisfy an r-fold energy norm, you might say, which I'm going to define to be 1/2 times the following combination. I'll take r. R many x derivatives of u, and then one more. And measure it in L2 squared, plus I'll take R many x derivatives of the time derivative of u, and I'll measure it in L2 squared, and I'll sum the squares of those two, and the statement is that this is equal to, so this is the definition, the statement is this is the, oh, this is u at time t, because this is a L2 and x norm, I'm sorry. So this is not neat. So this is the energy norm at time t. I'm defining it to be that. Is the same energy norm at time 0, which if I write that down, it's 1/2. Partial xr plus 1 on f L2 squared plus partial xr on g L2 squared. So it doesn't decay. And this is no surprise. So there's no change as time goes on. So this is no surprise. And the proof is, well, we proved this, I think we proved it twice in our last semester's lecture on the subject, in two different ways. So if R is equal to 0, it's true. So when R is equal to 0, we had two proofs last semester. Anyone want a reminder? No. So how about if R is greater than 0? Well, when R is greater than 0, just note that d by dx r of u is a solution of 1 when u of xd is itself. That is to say, d by dx r, d by dx commutes with the equation. And so therefore, what initial data does this take on? Well, exactly the r derivatives of f and the r derivatives of g. And so we're done, just by our work last time. But the time decay is a little bit more subtle. So here, the point is we start in L2, or we start with data whose derivatives are in L2, and then we measure them later on in L2 again, with derivatives in L2. But how about if we start with other ways of measuring? Or how about if we decide we want to conclude with other ways of measuring? So the classic thing is to study the wave evolution. I guess it's not quite what's called a wave operator. That's often something other else. But maybe this should be rather more called a wave operator. So let me see. W of t, and instead of taking a sublet, so we've decided that this takes hr plus 1 cross hr to hr plus 1 cross hr, and it preserves the norm. But instead, let's try another way of measuring, and in particular, the other way of measuring the target. So let's do the following thing. Let's start in L1 spaces. So what I want to do is I want to end up in L infinity spaces. And it's natural to start, where we want, where one can, but the estimate I'm thinking of, it starts in L1 spaces. So I want to take L1 norms on my initial data, and I want to measure the solution in L infinity spaces. Now that's a little bit vague, so let me be a little bit more precise. So more carefully, what I want to do is I'm going to reduce the general initial value problem to what's called a canonical initial value problem, and then I'm going to give an estimate for that. So to be more precise, so more carefully, study the following canonical, study A, or actually the canonical problem. Which is the following thing I want to study again. It's always this wave equation. So partial t squared u minus Laplacian u is equal to 0. I want x to be in Rn. But the canonical problem is the canonical initial data. So it turns out, with complete generality, I can set f to 0. And I can simply start with non-zero momentum. And if I can solve that problem, I can solve all the problems of interest. Let's think about it. Suppose I show you that from this problem, I can solve a problem with F2 by some combination of two solutions. Then I can solve the general initial value problem. But also using that solution, I can solve the inhomogeneous problem. from the previous blackboard, which is almost erased. So all I have to do is show you that it suffices to do the F equals 0, G non-zero case, and then I can do the F non-zero and the inhomogeneous problems in their own right. So let's just check that. And let's see how this goes. So I'm going to decompose my solution U of XT into, well, excuse the redundant notation, but a U1 and a U2, but they're not the same U1 and U2 as before. U1 of XT plus U2 of XT, where U1 solves, I need an equation number. Should I start at 1 again? Where U1 solves 1. But I have to find F somehow. So then set and call the solution operator. I'm actually going to do the following thing. I'm going to call the solution operator this. And that will be my solution operator. I should have done it in the other order. That is, my solution operator is going to be a solution of the canonical problem. So then, solve the following thing. You take, so that is, U1 of X and T is equal to WT applied to G of X. So next, we're missing the F. Set U2 of XT, do the following thing. Take F of X, apply WT to it, and now that's not U2 because such a thing has initial momentum equal to F. So take a T derivative of it, and that's U2. And that's, now let's just see if that works. So does this work? So we have to verify this. Well, first off, does U2 satisfy the wave equation? Well, the answer is partial by partial T also commutes with the wave operator. So, yes. If I put in the wave operator on U2, it's the wave operator on d by dt of something. So it's d by dt of the wave operator on something, and that something satisfies the wave equation. So the question is, does it satisfy the proper initial data? So it satisfies the equation. Does it satisfy the proper initial data? So let's look at U2 at x, 0, is equal to d by dt of wt of f evaluated at t equals 0. That's a function of x. But of course, this solution operator is the one whose value is 0, but whose derivative is that function in hand. So whose time derivative at 0 is that function in hand. So this is equal to f. What's the one thing left to check? Are we done? Well, we haven't checked that U2 doesn't ruin the initial momentum that U1 set. That is, we have to check that d by dt of U2 of x0, it better be 0 because we already set d by dt of U1 to be g, and we don't want to ruin the values of g. So let's try that. That's partial t squared of wtf at t equals 0. But of course, partial t squared of wf is equal to partial x, is equal to the Laplacian through the wave equation. So let's Laplacian of wtf, then evaluated at t equals 0. But this is this object where when t is equal to 0, it's 0. And Laplacian of 0 is 0, so this vanishes. what we conclude is it suffices to solve 1, because if I have W solving 1, d by dt of W solves the problem with given initial data and 0 initial momentum. So it's okay. Everyone with me? So now I'm being more specific. I'm going to now call this the wave operator, solution of problem 1, solution of the canonical problem, and I want to estimate it in L1 to L infinity spaces. That is, I want to take G in L1, and I want to see how fast the solution will decay. So that's my theorem. Have I got my number right? Yes. And I want to be let n be odd. Now there's a difference. Actually, there's not a difference in statement, but there's a difference in proof if n is even and n is odd, and n is even is more clumsy. So let's do the odd case. Solutions of the canonical equation, canonical problem, which is our problem 1, satisfy the decay estimate how big is it in L infinity? And that's, of course, you take WT operating on G, that's a function of X, and you estimate it in L infinity. It's an L infinity of X for fixed T, L infinity of X. And my claim is this is less than or equal to a constant over T to the N minus 1 over 2 times a number of derivatives of G. So N minus 1 over 2 G measured in L1 of X. So that is to say, the operator norm, that is to say, the operator norm of W of T, but as an operator from starting in L infinity, sorry, starting in L1, no, because I need derivatives. So starting in W1 with derivatives N minus 1 over 2, and ending up in L infinity, is less than or equal to C, that C over T to the N minus 1 over 2. That's what that statement says. Okay, know where we're going? So the rest of our time, I'm just going to go through the proof. Actually, what I'm going to do is two things. I'm going to give you a proof of this, which involves analyzing spherical means and a few integrations by parts. And then I'm going to give only the statement of what happens in even dimensions. Slightly, the statement is about the same. The proof is a little more clumsy. And I want to give an attribution to this. This estimate itself is out of a paper by Walter von Fall. And I forget what year, but it's in the 1970s, and I can get the exact reference for you. So the proof, let's express U xt in terms of spherical means. So let's see. We have a G, that's our data, and we have the mean of G, and that's a function of X. And I want to put R is equal to T. That's, of course, equal to 1 upon omega n, T to the n minus 1 integral over y, let's see, integral over c equals 1 of g of x plus t c ds c. Sorry, I don't have this factor if I do it in this way. And then if I refer to our work last week, we can express u in terms of spherical means. So there's a couple of ways of writing this. One was the following thing. We had the mean of G That's a function of x and t that I just wrote down. And then you multiply it by a dimension-dependent factor, n minus 2. And then you apply this operator, 1 upon t d by dt, to the n minus 3 upon 2 times, actually. And then that came out except for a constant. So you put in that constant, which was this double factorial constant. And that was the solution. But of course, why don't I just do all those derivatives, and I'll get some sum. That's one factor. But if I do all the derivatives, I'll get some sum, which looks a little bit more like this. Combinatorial coefficients alpha j powers t to the j, but it starts a little higher at j plus 1. And this goes j equals 0 up to n minus 3 upon 2. And then some of the derivatives fall on the t's, the other derivatives fall on the m's. So the d by dt of to the jth power m g of x and t. So the form of the solution looks like that. And then the object is to examine, well, all terms. I'm really just going to examine each term. And then add them all up. These are combinatorial coefficients. That's the solution. That's the solution form. So it takes a lot of derivatives and things. So without actually, I'm going to take g. So let's take g in c naught infinity of Rn. So I can do those derivatives and integration by parts. But of course, this is going to be dense in that space of the L1 functions with n minus 1 over n minus 2. How many derivatives? Yeah, n minus 1 over 2 derivatives. So I'm going to do it. I'm going to do an estimate where I can differentiate and integrate by parts with impunity, and then I'll make a density argument to finish to say, oh, it actually holds for every function and not just such g. But what counts is being able to do it at least simply for those g's. So let's do that. So let's see what expression enters in the solution formula. T, factors of t times derivatives with respect to t of the mean. So what I want to do is look at g of x plus tc and its derivatives. So here's g of x plus tc, and I'm going to have to take a number of derivatives. And what I want to do is express that in certain ways. Oh, and my comment is I want to measure that in L1, but at the moment I'm only taking integrals over spheres. So I want to do something to fill in the spheres, and that's basically integration by parts. So this is the same as minus the integral from t to infinity of derivatives of g of x plus sc, and there's j, and then I had one more to integrate by parts, so I have a j plus 1 ds. And that's an integral radially around x. And if I carry on integration by parts, I have a minus 1 to a certain factor, n minus 1 upon 2 minus j, integral from t to infinity. If I keep on adding derivatives to g, I can add factors of the difference between s and t in the integrand. So it's going to be s minus t. Oh, here s is bigger than t. So s minus t, I'm going to add a number of factors, and I'm going to move it up to n minus 3 over 2 minus j, because that's the factor that works out. Then I have to have s many derivatives of g, j plus 1. I augment those number of derivatives to n minus 1 over 2, g, x plus sc, ds. And I note that that's the number of derivatives that are going to be I'm going to be beholden to in the end, because that's right there. And then I don't just want this g, I want the spherical mean of this g. So let's see, I want to take the mean of this g, but also not just the mean. I look at my solution formula, and in this form here, I need j many t derivatives of the spherical mean of g. So I'll take dt to the j. spherical mean of G. And I want to know what that looks like at xt. So that's G, now I'm going to study the spherical mean of G and a bunch of derivatives of it. It didn't vanish. Because this is d by ds, so it's in the chain rule. So if I perform these s derivatives, I'd get gradients of g in x and xs, but I didn't. I kept them in s. So it's just one way to express the chain rule. Happy? C is bounded in any case, so it's not going to give any growth or decay. It's not going to be a problem, but it's a little bit of a ruse, but that's the way it is. Okay? So now let's express this. Well, I just write it out. It's a d by dt j many times the spherical mean. That's 1 over monomeva n. Integral over the C is equal 1. Of what is it? G of x plus t xc, d spherical mean. And we just figured out an expression for, oh, then these t's come in here, and we have an expression for that in terms of this. So let me put in our brand new expression for that in the next line. N minus 1 over 2 minus j. Integral t to infinity, that's this one, a factor, s minus t to the n minus 3 upon 2 minus j. Now I'll put in all the spherical mean stuff, 1 upon omega n, integral over c equals 1, lots of derivatives, n minus 1 over 2, many derivatives of g with respect to s, of s plus x, xc, finally d, big C, big sxc, and d little s. And and then the general term in our solution formula isn't just the time derivative with respect to j many times of the spherical mean, but a factor with t to the j plus 1. So if you forgive me to write this all down one more time, let's put that factor in. So the general term is t to the j plus 1, partial t to the j, mg of xt. And I want to write a formula down for that. And then, of course, my solution form just says add a certain number of those up with combinatorial coefficients alpha j. So it's a little bit boring, and I'm just going to repeat this. Minus 1 to the n minus 1 over 2 minus j, integral from t to infinity, integral over c equals 1, that's this integral. I have a t to the j plus 1. I have an s minus t to a power, n minus 3 over 2 minus j, n minus 3 over 2 minus j. I have a factor, 1 upon omega n. I have an integrand, which is partial s to the n minus 1 over 2 g, and that's evaluated at x plus sc. And then I have the two differentials, which I ran out of room, so I'll put them here. D spherical area, unit spherical area, ds. And I want to know the size of this thing. So it's estimated above by the size of this thing. And the size of this thing, well, let's see what's on the inside. There's the absolute value. I could put the absolute values on the inside. There's this, which looks like averages a bunch of directional derivatives of G. And there's this. So I want to estimate this first. It's some power of t. I want to estimate that first. So here's a proposition. 4.15, which is, I'm interested in the following j's, 0 up to and including n minus 3 upon 2. That's the kind of derivatives I'm going to need to apply to that's the number of j's in my sum. The top term in that sum, n minus 3 upon 2. That's how many partial by partial t's there are. And I also want 0 less than or equal to t, but s is bigger than t. Could be equal. That's the range I'm interested in. Then what does this factor look like? And my claim is t to the j plus 1, s minus t to the n minus 3 upon 2 minus j is bounded by some combinatorial factor that basically depends on n. It's an independent estimate on j. It's uniform over all j's. Well, it's a finite number of j's. S to the n minus 1 times a factor of t. T to the minus n minus 1 over 2. I'll prove it to you in a second, but let's see what we can do with this. S to the n minus 1, that's the, if I put an s to the n minus 1 here, that's a volume differential. That's the differential of volume. And so I'm going to integrate this d volume over some subset of the space, which I might as well only increase by integrating over all the space. That's the L1 norm of derivatives of g. T to the minus n minus 1 upon 2, that will also be here. That's the decay rate. That's what appears in the theorem. So if I get this, then I'm pretty much done. Let me make sure I do that. And I don't think we'll be later than a few minutes. Let's take the statement of the proposition and finish the proof. I now have u less than or equal to some sum, j equals 0 up to some n minus 3 over 2, in fact, of some combinatorial coefficients, alpha j, times t to the minus n minus 1 over 2, times integrals. Oh, and divided by omega n, times integrals. Let's get rid of this. Times integrals. Integral from t to infinity. Integral from c equal over the unit sphere of partial s to the n minus 1 over 2, is it? G of x plus s c, absolute value. S to the n minus 1, that's that other term that came out of the ds, d spherical surface area. And so this is bounded above by this g, the derivative of the g, d by dx to the n minus 1 over 2 g in L1. And this is some combinatorial constant over times t to the n minus 1 over 2. And we're done, and then we're done with the estimate. So that proves, that's end of proof. End of proof of 4.13 modulo 4.15. 4.14. Because I still have to check that that's the way that extra factor came in when we integrated by parts. It's the only thing. So what does one do? Let's look at the worst case. So this is proof. So it all depends. So this is proof of the proposition. So what do we have again? We have to worry about S minus T to a power and then we have to worry about S to a power. So what I want to do, I'm going to take this factor and this factor and worry about how big that can get. So I'm going to look at a function f, which is a function of s and t, which is s minus t to that power, what is it, n minus 3 over 2 minus j, divided by s to the n minus 1 power. And for fixed t, I'm going to vary in s. And I just want to optimize. How big is it? How big can that possibly be? So let's think of this. So fixed t, what about s? How does it behave in s? So here's the s-axis, and here's some t. So if we set t to 0, s is always greater than t. S is always greater than t. Well, when s, so t is fixed. When s descends, s is always greater than 0, too, of course, because t is positive. Well, if s descends to t, it's 0 here. As s goes to infinity, n minus 1 is a bigger power than this, so it's going to do something. It goes up, and then it goes down again. So what I want to know is, how big is it at its maximum? What's the biggest it can be at its maximum? So how do you do that? You take an s derivative of s minus t to the n minus 3 over 2 minus j divided by s to the n minus 1. And if you just do, I guess it's logarithmic differentiation, it's just n minus 3 over 2 minus j times 1 upon s minus t times f of st, I guess it is. I think that's what it is. Minus, I didn't do logarithmic differentiation right. There's another term, n minus 1 over s, f of st. And we're not worried when s is equal to t, and we're not worried when s equals infinity. We want to know where this is 0 in the middle. Equals 0, and you just check that it's 0 when n minus 1 t is equal to n plus 1 over 2 plus j, s. So let's say s is proportional by some constant, and that will depend on j to t. And then let's see what f of st is. Well, if you put s proportional to t, then this is some factor times t divided by some factor times t. So that says this is less than or equal to some factor aj times t divided by some factor bj times t. And this is to the power n minus 3 over 2 minus j, and this is to the power n minus 1. And we decided this is, you put all those constants together, you get a cj t to the minus n plus 1 over 2 plus j, just adding all those things up. And if you look over here, that's what we're asking. Put the s over here and the t's over here. This is t to the minus n minus 1 over 2, j plus 1, minus j plus 1. That's what it is. So the proof of the proposition is done. Sorry, we're not done. One more thing. And that is a theorem. 4.16, which is let n be even. Solutions of the canonical initial value problem one satisfy the L1, L infinity decay estimates. As follows, U of xt in L infinity, that's a measure in x, which is equal to the size of wt g measured in L infinity, bounded by some constant, depends on n, times n minus 1 over 2, that's now a fractional power because n is even, times sum j equals 0 to n over 2 partial xj g measured in L1. Slightly more complicated formula. And proof is similar but a little more clumsy because of the method of descent gives us a solution formula which is a little more clumsy. And let's stop here.